This evening, we're going to look at three verses, 30, 31, and 32. We began this series in Romans 9, 10, and 11 back in September of 2017. And when we did, I set it forth as a study of Paul's clarification of God's larger plan. And now as we draw near to the end, we find that Paul's argument for a shift in God's plan to bring a mystery to pass is, in effect, rooted in a long-established pattern of divine behavior. The mystery was defined in verse 25 that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. The mystery involved both the partial hardening and this whole idea that there was going to be a time devoted to the Gentiles, and until it came in, the fullness of it came in, this partial hardening would remain. The hardening was partial and it was temporary, because he said that there's going to come a time in verse 26 when all Israel will be saved, just as it's written. And then he quotes this passage in verses 26 and 27 that justifies his confidence that God's dealings with Israel have not come to an end, in spite of the fact that they have been instigators of the death of Messiah by their own determined, hard-hearted, arrogant boastfulness, which typically would be enough reason for anybody to say, okay, I'm done. I'm done with you. I've spent 1,500 years with this, and I'm done with you. I mean, if you stop and think about it, from creation to the flood was 1,656 years, if you trust the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 10, particularly 5. And it was 1,500 years from the time of Moses giving the law until the time they murdered the Christ. So basically a millennium and a half in both settings. The interesting thing was, in the first setting, God had said, my spirit is not going to keep on striving with these people. They've got 120 years, and then that's it. And then, of course, after that 120 years, flood came and wiped them all out. And perhaps people got the impression that God was done with the Gentiles, because for the next 2,000 years, 500 of which he was dealing with Abraham and the development of the patriarchs down to the coming of the law and Moses, but with a focus of 2,000 years on the Jews from Abraham down to the first century, you kind of did get the impression that maybe God had just written those Gentiles off, except for, you know, Nineveh when Jonah went there, and a few isolated events like that. And then Jesus even said on a couple of different occasions, if the men of Sodom had heard what you've heard, they'd have repented a long time ago. So the question is, well, why didn't they hear it? And point being that the Jews were caught flat-footed in the first century when God turned away from them, said, you're not my people any longer, in terms of the my people, not my people construct. And the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 was the capstone of an appearance of divine rejection. I've had it with you. And for the next couple thousand years, he's been dealing with the nations. And Israel has always been in that list, one of the many. I mean, it wasn't like God said, I'm not going to have anything to do with Israel anymore. But he did demote them to where they just kind of shared the whole platform with 15 other nations, because in Acts 2, when the Holy Spirit was given, there were 16 different language groups referenced, and one of them was the people in Judea. So he didn't completely write them off, but he demoted them from this special privileged position down to, you're just one of many. And of course, the Jews had never liked being demoted, being one of many. They didn't mind demoting God so that he was one of many, but they didn't want him dealing with them that way. So anyway, that was the reason for the brutal treatment that they executed on Jesus, because they didn't like his doctrine, and on Paul, and from then on. So, in effect, what we're arguing here is that this mystery of the blinding, as it turned out, of the majority part of Israel, larger part, not just a partial hardening, but a partial unto significant majority of Israel was hardened, so that a group of the nations could be developed. And of course, we know that group as the church, made up of every kindred, nation, tongue, and tribe. Except that we have this huge block of Christendom that believes that the church is Israel, and therefore they don't even recognize that there's a new group on the scene. It's just a spiritual form of the old group. Anyway, these three verses in verse 30 through 32 pretty much kill that idea if they would just study it. But I haven't ever read any of their commentaries, so I don't even know what they say about it, but it can't be right. Because these three verses pointedly talk about this cyclical thing. So Paul revealed this mystery in verse 25 by his own statement to combat the creeping turn by the Gentiles from grace in being wise in their own estimation, this capstone of arrogance because they've been boastful toward the Jews, they have a high opinion of themselves, and now he is talking about being wise in their own estimation, meaning they think their wisdom is coming from themselves. So he revealed this mystery to cut that off, because the Gentiles are showing signs of turning away from grace and going into a legal mindset where they can boast and they can feel superior and they can think of themselves more highly than they ought to think. Because that all comes from a perverted use of law, where you don't let the law address your own sinfulness, you only let it address other people's, and then you hold yourself up above them because you know that what they're doing is wrong and you can criticize it and all that kind of stuff. That's Romans 2. But in his explanation, he argued for another mystery of sorts, and that is his statement about how God turned to the nations in order to provoke Israel to jealousy so that they would come back around. And that really is kind of an odd methodology. Make them mad about the favor that the Gentiles are getting, and over time, they'll start longing to be included in that blessing that they can see out there that they're no longer a part of. So it's kind of an odd method, but Paul even says in this chapter that he's doing it because he says in verse 13, I'm magnifying my ministry if somehow I might move to jealousy my fellow countrymen and save some of them. So not only does God have this kind of weird method, Paul has adopted it as an effective working methodology. So God's deliberately using jealousy to draw the rejected back to himself. And we need to keep this in mind as we look at what he says in this three-verse section this evening, because the language without this understanding is kind of confusing. So this evening we're going to look into Paul's argument in verses 30, 31, and 32, and I think we'll see that it destroys the current popular theology that rejects any future for Israel by claiming that the church is Israel. So this idea that Israel became a nation again in 1948 is just happenstance. It doesn't have any theological significance to this group because Israel doesn't have a future in their understanding or misunderstanding, as the case may be. But in this text, verses 30, 31, and 32, Paul completely destroys that notion that Israel doesn't have a future. Paul's entire argument falls to the ground as soon as that heresy is embraced, because it wipes out almost all of the hopefulness of the eschatology of the New Testament, and particularly even vast portions of the Old Testament's prophetic scheme of things for Israel's ultimate development in the eschaton, when Messiah is actually here ruling on the earth. And Israel is the favored nation. It's the head and not the tail and all those kinds of terms. As soon as you say Israel is the church, you just wipe out all that stuff. Point B. Let's just look at what Paul says in verses 30 through 32 and we'll, I think, see it. First, let's just look at verse 29 one more short time. He declared that the gifts and callings of God are irrevocable. That's the New American Standard Translation of that idea that God simply will not give in to the plethora of competing concerns when it comes to gifts and calling. Those two are at the top of the heap, and it doesn't matter what's underneath them. He will not sacrifice these two. They become irrevocable because God says, we're going to make this happen, the gifts and the calling. And once we made it happen, there's nothing that will change it. He acknowledged in verse 29, from the standpoint of the gospel, they're enemies. But from the standpoint of election, they're beloved for the sake of the fathers. He acknowledged that if they were not beloved for the sake of the fathers, God would have rejected Israel by generating another group that wouldn't have Israel's attitudes. That's all theory. Because as long as we're human, we're going to develop those attitudes. The attitudes of arrogance and boastfulness and pride are not Jewish characteristics. They're human ones. That the Jews had honed them to a fine point, to the point where they would actually attempt to murder the God who created them and made them special. Yeah, they kind of stand out as a group who've kind of honed these tactics, but all they've done is hone the human depravity issues, and everybody falls into... That's why the Gentiles are turning away from grace so that they can be boastful and high-minded and all that kind of stuff. It's just this natural pull of the depravity of humanity. But they are beloved for the Father's sakes, and since they are, God remains committed to Israel, even though, for a while, he's generating another group for another purpose. So his turn to the nations does not mean that he's done with Israel. It does mean he's turning from Israel for a period because there's a partial hardening that has happened until the fullness of the Gentiles comes. But then, all Israel will be saved. So, you have God dealing with Israel, and then they get to this maximum point of rebellion and crucifying their Christ. So he turns to the nations to make them jealous, so that when the fullness of the Gentiles has come, they've had the time for this jealousy to eat away at them, so that they're ready now to hear about Jesus of Nazareth being the Christ, and they come. So that's the background of verses 30, 31, and 32, and it's important because in verse 28, he says, from the standpoint of the gospel, their enemies, standpoint of God's choice, their beloved for. They're beloved for the gifts and calling are irrevocable. For, verse 30, which means he's going to explain now why they're irrevocable. He's explaining in verse 29 why they're still beloved, but in verse 30 he's explaining why the gifts and calling are irrevocable. He's going to give his rationale now for his declaration that they are still within the focus of God's commitments because his gifts and calling are not going to be sacrificed for any cause. His integrity is on the line and he is not going to sacrifice that. He spent 6,000 years trying to get people to believe him because he speaks the truth and he is not about to sacrifice the foundation for faith, which is integrity, for any cause, and he is not. So if you can demonstrate that God lied to Abraham when he said he was going to make a great nation out of him and make him a father of many nations, then you've kind of shot the whole issue of faith in this God because he has no integrity. But you're going to have to prove that. You can't. So the rationale in verse 30 is, for just as, verse 31, so these also. So you have this just as, so then. This is his rationale. So verse 30 is a just as, which means there's a pattern here. And because this pattern is here, then also you're going to see it here. And then verse 32 is another for, which explains this pattern thing. Okay? That's why we have to cover all three of them, because they're all connected. But anyway, the rationale of a just as, so then, for, God has done this. The just as has to do with the Gentiles. You were once disobedient to God. When he says you found yourself basically involved in this condition that I've summarized by using Paul's summary word, alienation. In Ephesians 2:12, he says that remember, you Gentiles were alienated from the commonwealth of Israel. You were without God in the world. Remember that. And then in chapter 4 of Ephesians, verse 18, he talks about being alienated from God. And then in Colossians 1:21, he talks about being as the Gentiles alienated from God. So I just picked up that concept and plugged it in here because the issue is you were once disobedient to God. That proves your alienation. You are separated from God by your attitude and actions. And in a very real historical sense, God has pretty much allowed that to continue for several hundreds of years while he's dealing with this other part of his plan. Because everything God does is coming to a conclusion, but he's working over here, and then he's working over here, and then got multiple trails to this result, because there are many things that have to come together all at the same time. That's in that concept in Galatians, when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth his Son, which meant all the pig trails had finally come down to this. And now it's time for this thing that's been being pointed to all this time to happen. And that's the way God is working in history. You found yourself alienated from God. And I chose that alienation thing, as I said, because Paul kind of uses it as a summary description of the condition of the Gentiles before the coming of the gospel to them. In our current text, the manifestation of the alienation is summed up by the phrase, in the New American Standard, you were once disobedient to God. I really don't like that translation, partly because I don't like the theological drift that's going on in our own cultural setting in evangelical Christendom, because I constantly am hearing the preachers of the word banging on people's heads to guilt them into trying to get them to do what he thinks they ought to do, and it's almost always going to be on the basis of their failures, their disobediences. And I really think that preachers would get a lot more accomplished if they would focus on the real problem, which is at the root of this word translated disobedience. It's the word apatheia. The a is a negative particle, and patheia is a word for belief. Pistis, pistos, and pisteo are words that come off this concept of pytho, which means to be persuaded. So if you're apatheia, it means you're not persuaded. And the statement in verse 30 is not so much that they were disobedient to God. It's a statement of you were unpersuaded by God. In other words, what he tried to persuade you of, you resisted to the point that you caused him to turn away. You were unpersuaded by him. Now, in our study last week, I'll admit that the gifts and the calling issues, God doesn't give up when it comes to those two things. If you're not persuaded by him the first time he approaches the idea, he will approach it again until he finally wins. And we used Moses and Paul as our examples, where God had determined long before they were born, without ever asking their permission, that they were going to be his servants for this particular task and for this one. And it didn't matter whether they readily agreed or fought tooth and nail against the idea. God said, this is the way it's going to be. Get used to it. And of course, Moses made him mad. So Moses, being singed by some of that hostility that he had created, decided he'd better not pursue that course any further. And then Saul of Tarsus, he wasn't quite that way, because when he actually was confronted on the road to Damascus, not counting the confrontation at the stoning of Stephen and all those other times that God confronted him, but he didn't know it was God, when there was no way to get around the fact that it was God who had said, you're persecuting me and I want to know why, well, Saul had to ask some questions too. Well, why am I? And he spent 3 days fasting in prayer, because he couldn't answer the question, why have I been so wrong so long? But the point is, God wanted him to be his apostle to the nations, and he was going to be his apostle to the nations, whatever it took, because the gifts and calling are irrevocable. So, we have this focus on being unpersuaded by God, and the idea of the word is a most necessary truth, because disobedience is automatic to lack of persuasion. You can't be persuaded and then be disobedient. If you're really persuaded of a certain thing being true, your behavior will align itself with this truth because you see it as the truth. And it would be just plumb dumb not to acquiesce. My old illustration, if I tell you the house is on fire and you hear some crackling and you kind of smell some smoke and then a haze kind of appears in the room, you realize I'm telling you the truth. And because it's now true, you've been persuaded not only by my statement but by the smoke and the crackling and perhaps even a little heat. Yeah, I just go sit there. That ain't happening. Because that's what persuasion does. Well, the lack of persuasion is exactly the opposite. If you don't believe it, no preacher, you're not going to get me to believe that. I know what you're after. You're, you know, whatever. The fact that they were unpersuaded by God means that God had done some things to persuade, and they had rejected it. And we've talked about that. But the fact is, as an issue of lack of persuasion, it means you haven't believed God. And the reason for the difference in the AV, which is focused on the actual issue, the Authorized Version actually says you didn't believe God. The New American Standard goes from the lack of belief to the natural outworking, which is disobedience. And to be fair, this word, apatheia, is actually used about children who are disobedient to their parents in another text written by the same author. But even then, the childish disobedience to the parents is rooted at some point in what they believe and are persuaded of. I think that Paul's grammar indicates that he considers the Gentiles' former state as most fundamentally a result of being subject to certain truths and actions by God, but they ended up being unpersuasive because of the determination of the person witnessing it to reject that as truth because of the implications that it would have on his own life and the lack of faith in any of these other areas. I mean, if you have a lifestyle that has rooted your financial and material well-being in dishonest practice, business practices, and somebody presents the gospel to you and you have any sense at all, you will recognize that if you acquiesce to the gospel, you're going to have to find a different line of work. And for some people, that's just not acceptable. So it really doesn't matter if the gospel comes across as persuasive or not. It's not going to be accepted because it's going to cost too much. And I'm not going to pay that kind of price. And so they turn around and walk away. Well, that the whole idea there is that God presented some things that should have been persuasive, but there are other problems. And so you end up not being persuaded by God because of other agenda issues. And I think that the history of this Gentile development of not being persuaded by God was actually given in Genesis. God began his post-Genesis 3, we'll call that post-fall labors, in respect to humanity by dealing with all of humanity, Gentiles, if you want to actually talk about them as national entities, because there is a table of nations in Genesis 10, but admittedly that's post-fall, I mean that's post-flood, but we'll get to that in a minute. Point is, when Adam and Eve sinned in the garden and God imposed his discipline upon them, they began to reproduce themselves in children, and then there were a whole host of people that were born over a 1656 year period because these guys that were promoting or producing these kids are living over 900 years. I don't know how many kids you can have if you live to be 900, but a bunch. So I don't know how many thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions of people there were by the time the flood came. But the point is, he had been dealing at that point with a Jew-less mindset. In other words, there was no special nation. These were just all of his creation, the people from Adam and Eve, and he was dealing with them. But his dealings with them revealed that these Gentiles were notable for their bondage to their own depravity in spite of some special efforts that God is making. The problem with the human depravity thing shows up immediately. As soon as Adam and Eve have their first child, and then have their second child, and then their first child murders his brother. There is a graphic demonstration of what has happened to humanity right there. The depravity that came from the eating of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil didn't even take one generation to show itself in its most grievous form, fratricide. All that proves is that they were in bondage to the depravity. And it's interesting that in this bondage to their depravity, God says, my spirit is not going to strive with these people forever. I'm going to give them another 120 years, and that's going to be the end of that. And the whole point there is that he actually says his spirit is striving with them. And you have to, I think, assume that his striving was for their repentance so that God could correct them, edify them, build them up in truth. But they wouldn't have it for the most part. There was a period in that 1656-year period where it says that at a certain point men began to call on the name of the Lord. But apparently it was a temporary thing because at the end of that period, God just killed them all. All but eight were just wiped off the planet because they were air breathers and he flooded the whole thing higher than the highest mountain. You would think that that would be kind of a pretty sharp lesson. But after Noah and his sons reproduced a new generation of humanity over the next 400 or 450 years, they have come to the building of the Tower of Babel in direct disobedience, which proves that they were not persuaded by God, by his action of destruction at the flood. They were not persuaded by God to walk in some humility before him and believe him. They weren't persuaded. So what did he do? Well, he'd said, I'm not going to flood the world again, so that option was out. So he just confused their languages so they couldn't work together. Then they did what he told them to do in the first place, but they did it under duress because they didn't have any other options. If you were one of those that were speaking German, you just naturally grouped yourself with those that you could understand, and then in a little while you kind of drifted off into your own little group, and then if you speak in Chinese, well then same thing happened, and all these language groups just kind of naturally shifted and split and splintered and separated, and then they actually spread out over the planet like God intended in the first place. We can say that in verse 30 of Romans 11 that you were unpersuaded by God. And the beginning of that lack of persuasion is evidenced by the flood and then by Babel. And so at the Babel thing, God says, okay, we've had 2,000 years now of this nonsense. He just confused their languages and sent them on their way. And he turned to a man named Abram and he began to deal with this man. And he made him some phenomenal promises about how he was going to be a father of many nations. But he was married to a barren woman. So, you know, there were all kinds of issues that had to be developed, theologically and at the practical living level. Not that theology is not practical living level, but there were some things that Abraham had to learn about God, but there were also some things that had to happen. So, the disastrous judgment of the flood didn't persuade them, and the separation by their languages didn't persuade them. At that point, God, in effect, turned his back on them, turned to one man. And at this point, the Gentiles were officially not my people, quote unquote. That's the Old Testament text. That place where they're called not my people, they shall be called my people. That's in this argument, because Paul used that terminology himself, quoting from those passages in the Old Testament. In a very real sense, the Gentiles are now not my people, and Abram and his seed become my people. So a pattern began to be revealed. A rejection of a people because of their refusal to accept persuasion, and a turn to another people in order to eventually bring the rejected people back. Because on the day of Pentecost, after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, you have the return to Babel with a solution. You have these 16 different language groups represented, and the Spirit of God gives speech to the disciples so that they can speak the truth about God in all these 16 different languages, having never learned any of them but one, or maybe two. So Pentecost is actually the return to Babel. God says, okay, I'm going to turn back to these nations that I turned my back on 2,000 years ago. And the proof of it was in the fact that he addressed his glorious character and turned the gospel toward the people that he had formerly rejected. So here's the pattern. God starts working with the people. They harden themselves and are unpersuaded by him, regardless of how severe the persuasion might be. And so he turns away from them and turns to another group. But his turn to the other group, it wasn't a rejection of these people totally. It was, I'm turning to these to make them jealous so they'll want to come along. And in fact, he even said that one of Israel's big tasks was to show the glory of God to all the nations so that they would want to worship the right God, the true God. Well, that doesn't happen easily, but this is the principle. Hardness responded to by rejection, turned to another group. They develop into hardness down through the centuries, until it gets to the point where God says, okay, and he turns his back on them, and then he turns to another group, which happened to be the former group, the nations, the Gentiles. So here's the pattern, a cycle. Well, this pattern thing is the whole idea of a demonstration by God of how he's dealing with his creation, and it's a cyclical thing. He creates them, they rebel. He puts them under disciplinary judgment, and that leads to catastrophic judgment, and then continued rebellion. So he says, okay, we'll put you on the shelf a while. I'm going to do something else over here. So he turns to Abram and develops Israel, and for the next 2,000 years, he's working with an obstinate, hard-hearted, stiff-necked people. And they're so bad that when it comes to the climax of their rebellion and lack of persuasion by God, I mean, you'd think the Babylonian captivity, the Assyrian captivity, the restoration of the nation after Babylon would be enough to persuade you, but not if you don't want to be persuaded. So he says, okay, and we'll put you on the shelf, and we'll go back to the original group, and we'll work with them until you finally decide, out of jealousy, that you would like to get involved in this too, and then we'll turn back to you and bring the Gentiles under judgment. That's the Great Tribulation and all that stuff. So, the pattern's here. Now, having said all of that, the presently rejected because of their drift into hardened disbelief will eventually, according to verse 30, look, you once were disobedient to God. You were unpersuaded by God. But now, you have been shown mercy, not because of anything in you, but because of Israel's disobedience. They have become hardened like you were 2,000 years prior. And because of that, God has decided to go back to you in order to draw them again. There's a method in this madness. So, according to verse 30, you have this argument that you Gentiles were unpersuaded by God, so he rejected you, but now, 2,000 years later, he's shown you mercy because the people that he turned from you to have now become like you were. Unpersuaded. Now, according to verse 31, so also, these also now have become unpersuaded by God, in order that because of the mercy shown to you, they may now be shown mercy. Now, the mercy shown to you, he's already told us what that means. It means I'm going to provoke them to jealousy. I'm going to turn to you and shower you with all these blessings and make them sorry they ever walked away. And make them wish they could have it. And when the wish gets to a certain point, they'll be granted it again. When the fullness of the Gentiles has come. So the just so, also then, the thing is, here's the original beginning of this pattern. And now you have the second pattern, exactly the same kind of pattern. It's just a different group of people. With you, with them. And then you have the coup de grace, verse 32. The reason for this cyclical pattern thing, nations, Israel, back to the nations, back to Israel, is because, according to verse 32, God has shut up all into this issue of lack of persuasion so that he can show mercy to all. In other words, he is allowing the disobedience that has come out of the lack of persuasion to do its nefarious work of making experience so bad that finally people have gotten to the point where they're desperate for a real solution. I mean, you can rise up in arrogance early on, and you can stick with your arrogance until it kills you. And your offspring can stick with your arrogance until it kills them. But at some point, somebody's going to say, you know, this is nuts. This is killing us. I think maybe it would be a good idea if we turn back to the God who made us and let him give us life. That's the whole idea of the pattern. When Paul took the gospel to the Gentiles after 2,000 years of being rejected by God, he found a ready audience. It's always surprised me. He would go into these Gentile towns, preach a gospel, be there 3 weeks, and there'd be a church. You'll never see that happen in the real world. And the reason is because the situation there was primed. When the fullness of the time was come, this all transpired. And by the same token, Israel has now been being rejected by God for their lack of persuasion for 2,000 years. And there is an opening awareness in Israel these days of a hunger to have something better than what they've had for the last 2,000 years, having been rejected by God without argument because the destruction of Jerusalem killed any argument you wanted to make. And so you have a whole host of Jews now that are actually becoming believers in Jesus through the preaching of Gentiles. And those people are simply the argument that it's working. And there will come a time when the process with the Gentiles has reached its climax that all Israel will turn. They'll be saved. And that's, according to verse 32, that's the reason for this whole thing. God wants to show mercy to every group. But when he showed mercy to them, they didn't want it. So they were unpersuaded and disobedient. And so he turned away from them because they turned away from the quiet flowing rivers to the raging torrents of death. And he let them just wallow in the torrents of death for the next couple millennia while he's working with another group. But they're just like the former group. They get arrogant and proud and boastful and unpersuaded, and they develop that to a maximum. And God says, okay, I'll put you on this death watch thing for the next however many years and see how it works with you. He knows how it's going to work. It's going to bring them around. Now, the tragedy of all this, I suppose, is the individuals. Because what Paul is dealing with in this text is a great big long period of time in which he is not replacing Israel with a new Israel. He's not making the church the real Israel. He is simply dealing with humanity that rejected him from the beginning, from Genesis 3. And then he took a slice out of that humanity called Israel. But they weren't any different. So he dealt with them, and in 2,000 years, they proved that they weren't any different than the Gentiles and their arrogant lack of persuasion. But all that wasn't lost, because when he reached that, these Gentiles that had been set on the shelf are now ready to hear it. And so the church is exploding in numbers, primarily Gentiles now. And the history of the church since Jesus came until now is a history of gradual disintegration and the same kind of arrogant rebellion. So that we actually have right now a guy running for president of the United States who says that he is more gay than you can imagine and he's a Christian to boot. Well, when you get that confused, you're really, really in the latter stages of total disaster. And I think that's where we are. So I'm, you know, going on record by saying I think the fullness of the Gentiles is almost done. And then we'll have all Israel being the focus of God for salvation. It's going to be a terrible time. I mean, they're going to come to salvation in excruciatingly difficult, tribulational times. But Messiah is going to come back and establish this kingdom that they've been longing for. I think inherently they know that the kingdom of God is righteousness, peace, and joy. They just have taken this long to wake up. But I think these three verses actually establish the fact that Paul was all the way from chapter 9 through 11 explaining his larger plan.